close them behind doors. When I was listening to the previous conversations, there was a comment made about citizens are afraid that politicians are making big money or that they're cashing in on their experience, and that's indeed one of those main fears of citizens. They are afraid that they're kind of helping through a sort of legal system to create this elite decision-making model. And often staffers are viewed as the extension of elected officials. It's hard for citizens to kind of distinguish between this is my official that I elected in this seat and the group that supports that official throughout all the years is really a different part of it. So I wanted to give you just a little bit of a summary on the matter on this topic and like where current research stands, and that it is really about the perception instead of the actual outcomes or actual results for that. So I want to thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take any questions if you have
them. Well, thank you for yours. Just first, your testimony provoked a comment, and then I do have a suggestion or at least a query about a topic or two to research here. Because this combination of psychology and public policy is very interesting. First, the comment is that, last night we had a public budget forum. Mm-hmm. There are 18 people in the chambers now. There were 300 there. There were no paid lobbyists, and the room was suffused with, and I don't believe there was any press, although there's press here now.
David Ashton
was there.
CDX.
Yeah. The room was suffused with a feeling that people had their say. And it was, I think all of us felt like the second of our two public budget forums, that we really have an open and accessible process in which, in this case, a lot of young soccer players got to come in and advocate for their soccer program in the Parks Bureau. And a lot of parents of kids that go to preschools at city community centers got to come in and advocate for that. And again, don't take my gloss on it. Go look up the tape and watch the 3 hours. But my perception was that was genuine democracy, uninfluenced by special interests, and with an elected body genuinely listening to their citizens. You know, sounds like self-praise. Take it at that as you want, or go watch the video and reach your own opinion. But it contrasts sharply with this proceeding in which we are purporting to talk about the public, but only a handful are here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's my question. I think there are a couple of areas in public policy, and it would be interesting if you or someone else could research this, where essentially because of the fear of looking bad, elected officials are wary of stopping the march. One is ethics legislation, which we're talking about, and the other is security. That there's this relentless march of always more security. Well, we have to have metal detectors now in our city buildings, and there never comes the day when the security professional says to the elected official, you know, it's a safer world. You can take some of that junk out of here. And so when I arrived as mayor, I had to make the decision, or I chose to make the decision, it's okay. We don't need those stupid flippers on the ground floor of City Hall and someone asking which office you're going to in order to be safe. We can do something else. But someone had to take the political risk of swimming against the tide. And I'll celebrate that I did that. It's still a little controversy on this council, but
I think
it was the right thing to do. It restored this to being a public building. But there would never be a day when a police chief or a security professional, who after all is on the payroll to provide security, would say, you know, Mayor, it's a safer world. You don't need that junk. Get it out of here. Well, it's kind of the same thing with ethics. There will never come a day when an ethics regulator comes to a public official and says, you know, we didn't really need to duplicate the state code, and we don't really need all this code. It was working fine. You can go back to a less regulated environment. So I think it's an interesting problem for those who study government. If it's a one-way street, how do you ever get back to balance?
That's a great question. I'm not sure if I'm able to answer it entirely. I think that's indeed a political risk that a politician takes. I'm sure that for an elected official like all of you are, the public perception works really hard in favor of you or against you. And if you're, like, from the security perspective, it's almost a political suicide to say, now I'm not tough on crime, because everybody is expected to be tough on crime. I'm not saying that somebody is soft on crime, but saying, well, we're doing what we should be doing, and it's okay like this. Like I mentioned, I'm not here to plead in favor of the proposal or plead against it. I'm here to raise awareness about that public perception, awareness of potential conflict of interest. And I think if the city council could make convincing and persuasive argument that what is currently provided is sufficient, then it is at that point indeed the political risk that you take, whether citizens perceive that that's the case or not.
I think the mayor's point was there's people who it's never going to be sufficient for, that it's always going to be, you got to do more, you know. And, you know, with all due respect to our election officer, I mean, she went to a conference, you know, probably a taxpayer-paid conference, heard about best practices, what other cities are doing, and Portland's very competitive. We like to be on the top of the heap,
mm-hmm.
you know, so therefore we come back and suddenly we have some new recommendations. It's time to update our ethics law. Whereas I think the mayor was pointing out, you know, the 2005 law seems to be working pretty well. So I guess that's the point he's trying to make, is there's never going to be a sufficiency in certain people's eyes.
But we are put in the position of being against ethics, just like we would be against security.
Right.
And so politically, that's very difficult for elected officials.
Right.
It's an emperor's new clothes problem.
Right. Yeah.
I would say, though, in fairness, I know we're having a this, at some point in this debate, you're going to give us college credit for this, but I do think we are at risk here of leaving some important things out, which is it's precisely because we typically have so few people in this chambers, and the people that are here are generally so unrepresentative of the city we serve, that we hear from people in the community that they want to see more sunshine, because sunshine is the way that they have confidence in tracking what we do, because we disclose things. I frankly haven't, the lobbying rules may or may not be a success, but I don't often hear from lobbyists complaining about it. The safe harbor provisions actually exclude a lot of the groups because of the 8-hour rule, that for whom this would be burdensome. So I come at this a little differently. I think sunshine is intrinsically a good thing. And I think the more transparent we are, the more confidence people generally have in our work. How we talk about that, to the mayor's point, is important, because I too bristle at the idea that ever since Amanda, Steve, Dan, you and I got elected, somehow our character became less worthy. My experience in government is very high standards of character and ethics generally. But I think that this idea of doing our business in the sunshine in a very transparent way, as a way of, depending on your point of view, building or maintaining public trust, is a very important thing. And it's not just me saying this. It's the reason that there are all these wonderful public interest groups around the country representing grassroots people fighting for it. I would actually argue, in fact, that this, I hope we have this same debate, although even go deeper, if in some point in the future there's a desire to bring back a discussion about public financing of campaigns. Because frankly, I have often felt that the language we use there, Charlie, is even more pernicious.
Yeah.
And I'm a big believer in transparency and contributions, and I would love to see Citizens United overturned, and I'd like to see stricter contribution limits. But, you know, the idea that at some point, the last time we debated public finance here, the provision was called clean money, which inherently suggested that the money that a lot of my friends take is less than clean. And I think we have to be careful about how we frame these things, because there may be a public interest in moving in a particular direction, But I don't think that we necessarily have to establish base corruption as the point of departure for having those discussions. And so, and I know we wouldn't do that if we were discussing public finance. I hope we can also in this context recognize that there are some inherent goods that we hear from ordinary people who are not generally here because they're working or they can't hire Steve Janik or they don't have a lobbyist or whatever, where they feel more connected to their government because we make this extra effort to be transparent. And frankly, I even think that that appearance standard is an important standard because I know how high the ethics are of my colleagues. And I know that people try to follow the letter and the appearance. And I think it inherently reaps dividends in building and maintaining public trust.
Thank you so much. Appreciate Actually, you being here. Questions?
I just have to get on this. I appreciate your saying that you're not going to restore trust in government simply by passing more ethics laws. Because, right. I mean, I've done something of a study of the history of trust in government, and trust in government was at an all-time high in 1964 when we didn't have any ethics laws or government of the sunshine laws, but we had had 20 years of uninterrupted shared prosperity, and people remember beating the Nazis. And now we've had middle-class income stagnating since 1973, and we've got more ethics laws, but people don't trust government. And I suspect that unless we do something about income inequality, we'll continue to see lack of trust in government, and rightly so. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't pass strong ethics laws, but it sounds like you agree that that's not the only thing we need to do.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. Like, context always matters as well. And we see public trust go down even, like, in minor fluctuations when the economic circumstances are bad, or even when usually even in an election year because there's so much more attention actually in focus on the government. Public trust is not only based on the integrity of the government. It's based on so many other variables.
I think really, trust goes down in election years?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I didn't know that. Makes sense, though.
This is the exception during your campaign.
I'm not so sure about that.
But I also, I think one of the things that we also need to acknowledge is that a precipitous decline in civic literacy is at the root of a lot of these challenges. And, you know, the last poll that was done in Oregon where 50% of the respondents didn't answer correctly the question, how many U.S. senators do we have, that a lot of people couldn't name them. It does seem to me that as we have declining civic literacy, in part because we're not teaching civics mm-hmm. correctly, in part because we have sometimes the mainstream media doesn't really cover local events in a way that would give people meaningful information, that as civic literacy declines, it's not surprising to me that trust also declines, because I think you have to first have a baseline of understanding in order to make certain judgments. And I think those of us who've been on the ballot know that as people become less familiar with what we do, it's easier to disparage what we do because there's no baseline of sort of established norms about talking about what we do. We just sort of, whatever myth has enough money behind it can actually make a dent. I will say around trust that going through the worst recession in our lifetime, the city, after getting pounded with a recession, we still, according to the auditor's survey, are about 50% in terms of public satisfaction with what we do, which when you consider where Congress is a minor miracle. It's actually a minor miracle that we are at about a 50% rate.
Thanks again. We appreciate you being here. Thank you. Are there other invited speakers, or should we turn right to the sign-up sheet? Or come on up, please.
We'll be breaking for dinner in about half an hour and coming back for the second round.
It's been that kind of day. Good afternoon.
Hi, I'm Debbie Iona, representing the League of Women Voters of Portland, something I say every time I come up here because I know the rules.
You are the exception that proves them.
So the League was an early supporter of the city's lobbyist registration program, and along with other good government and public interest organizations, assisted Commissioner Sam Adams during the development process. As with any city program, regular evaluation and updates increase effectiveness and address changing circumstances. The League is pleased to support Auditor Hall Caballero's proposed improvements. From the beginning, there was a desire to set a reporting threshold that would capture the activities of not only nonprofit volunteer organizations like the League and City Club and associations such as the PBA, but also other highly influential lobbyists operating in City Hall. The hourly threshold was reduced from 16 to 8 hours in 2007 for that purpose. Instituting the financial threshold is a welcome addition, and we encourage the Auditor's Office to monitor its effectiveness over time and take additional steps if necessary. The broadened scope and length of the prohibition on former city employees' ability to lobby will help improve the public's confidence in the integrity of our city government. There should be a clear line between public service and private interests, and this provision is a big step in the right direction. The increased financial penalties for violations are appropriate, given the fact that they have not been adjusted since 2005 and do not cover the cost of enforcement. It is reassuring to know, however, that the Auditor's Office will write administrative rules that describe the factors she will consider when setting fines for violators. A $3,000 fine for an all-volunteer organization like the League would have a much greater impact than a fine of that size on a large corporation. Then I just want to address a little bit about the conversation that's been going on. You know, we recognize that Oregon and Portland are not, you know, hotbeds of corruption and criminality. But even in spite of that fact, I think it's important for the public to know, you know, what's going on behind closed doors. And that, to me, is one of the things that this lobby program does. I also, to talk about the higher level city officials being prohibited from lobbying for 2 years, you know, when I look at those lobby reports and see the name of somebody who used to have a job in City Hall, you know, I think that person probably has a lot easier access to coming to speak to you or your staffs than ordinary citizens or even representatives of volunteer organizations like the League. And, you know, it's not terrible or anything. It just feels like that's something that sort of undermines people's feelings about how decisions are being made. And that's why I think it is important to really think carefully. I mean, maybe that you want to think of some adjustments to do some sort of a lesser prohibition on at-will city council staff. Maybe not the chief of staff, but maybe down to the, you know, the next step down. But I do think that a two-year prohibition seems fair. And I think in the case of Zeri, if she was working as a volunteer on that project, this new provision wouldn't apply. But you'd have to double check with Auditor about that. So,
but if it had been paid?
No, I agree. On the paid, she wouldn't be able to do it.
And you think that's appropriate?
Well, although if she's just working with city staff, my sense is that's not lobbying. If she was helping design some sort of a new thing around the Rose Garden, I guess I could be understanding this completely wrong, but my sense is she isn't coming to you and saying, I want to do this. She's working with Parks Bureau staff to help think about...
Well, they make a presentation to the Planning Commission, so... But take Ron Paul's example.
I don't
Ron
think
Paul,
that counts
Ron Paul
lobbying.
Worked for me, worked for PDC, then went to work for the James Beard Public Market Foundation, mm-hmm. seeking city funds. He was never shy about
it. Oh, yeah. No, I definitely realized that.
I wasn't here to lobby, but there were other people here to lobby.
But it's just 2 years. 2 years, that's
but
it.
You're saying he shouldn't do. He should not have done that.
He may not have done it for two
but
years.
You're saying he should not do it. If that scenario were recreated today.
Yeah.
That would be wrong.
I think a two-year cooling off period is fair, and then he can do it all he wants. And he does do it. He did do an excellent job at it. I saw him many times presenting about the public market. But a two-year prohibition seems like a fair amount of time.
And are you concerned that we would lose a lot? I am, in terms of people being willing to serve on staff here, and what we would gain from a Ron Paul doing what he did in the city after he left city service, or what Zeri's done in the city, or, you know, Mike Lindbergh, the only elected official that I can think of from the city council in our lifetime, mm-hmm. who has engaged in any kind of lobbying since he left the council?
Jim.
Okay, Jim Francesconi as well. So fairly rare instances, but frankly, in my case, in my view, they're all positive. Of course, it's understood in public that they used to be an official here. So I'm very worried about what we lose in the effort to appear to be pure.
But again, as the professor talked about, is appearance is also important.
But isn't the transparency what we're after?
Well, that too. I think this cooling off period is also important. No, I agree with you. The transparency to me is the most important thing. That's what we really, you know, we really need to know, right?
Yeah. So why do you perpetuate with your choice of words behind closed doors? What do you mean by that?
Well, because the meetings are, I engage in meetings behind closed doors with you, but we report them. So that's what I'm saying is I think the lobbying program
We report every meeting we have.
So do I, yeah.
Yeah, so why do you say,
the
phrase that contributes to the low esteem held by elected officials by using that phrase behind closed doors. The insinuation is we don't meet with the public, we only meet with lobbyists. And you know that's not true. Have you ever not been able to get a meeting with any one of us? No.
It depends, right, yeah.
No, I think the answer is no. And the point is we all have open-door policies. Anybody who wants to meet with us can meet with us. All they have to do is request a meeting. I'm sure that I speak for all five of us in that regard.
Were you there last night? I didn't see you.
No, I didn't.
I mean, the contrast with last night is just breathtaking.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, no. I mean, I have been to the, you know, to big public meetings like that. It is. It's wonderful.
Debbie, can I throw you a little softball?
Yes, go ahead.
The mayor has, I think, raised a couple of excellent examples. And by the way, every time you mention Ron Paul's name, I hope we soon have a conversation about how to truly honor his legacy.
Amen.
And before your term's over, Mayor, because you have been a champion for that. Do you draw a distinction between someone like Ron Paul, who goes out and leads a quasi-public-spirited effort to build a public market, and whether he went to work for Exxon and came back trying to undermine our climate action plan or something? I'm just making it up. But if there was a waiver provision or a distinction to be made, do you draw a distinction between those two paths?
That certainly makes sense. Yeah, it's definitely worth exploring that kind of option. I don't want to say for sure I know
the answer
to that.
The mayor has mentioned a couple of examples of things which I think instinctively sound like advancing the public interest around a park or a market, which to me, I'm not drafting an amendment here, but do seem to me qualitatively different than using where we're likely to be quite underpaid if at all.
Yeah.
and there's a city interest and a public benefit here, which is different from just purely mercenary work.
Well, and I didn't just pick those for effect. I mean, again, you work in Salem, too. I mean, Salem is
really
full of lobbyists working for corporations.
Uh-huh.
We hardly ever see one, right? We see lobbyists working for community development corporations like REACH or NEA. They have to describe themselves as lobbyists, right? Those are the lobbyists that we see. And I didn't just pick those examples because I didn't want to talk about all the city staff members who went out to work for Exxon. I can't think of anybody. This is Portland.
I know.
Everybody goes to work for a nonprofit.
Absolutely.
So I just can't think of the pernicious scenario. And the trouble with issues like this, whether it's security or this, is that, or term limits, if I may make a really strange comparison. But we get mad at Congress, and we enact local law.
Yeah.
Because we can't change Congress. Yeah. Congress is a swamp. There's a place that needs more ethics legislation and term limits too, right? But they have neither.
Charlie, I'm proposing an amendment. I'm opposing term limits for this body.
The League agrees with you.
If you're concerned about the next shoe dropping, I'm going to move that.
Well, I definitely think that there's, you know, I think if I heard right, you're thinking that you'll continue this conversation. I do think that those kinds of things should be considered. Is this person going out and helping a nonprofit or working for a nonprofit on something? You know, maybe there's a way to make distinctions on the revolving door policy. So,
and Debbie, I just wanted to let you know that most of my staff have confided to me that their real ambition is to go to work for the League of Women Voters lobbying for ethics reform, and I would hate to deprive them of that opportunity.
We're volunteers, though, remember.
Thank you very much, Debbie. Thank you. Others that are invited, or then do we want to turn to the sign-up sheet? Go ahead, please.
Okay, I show three others. David Delk, Kate Titus, and Craig Rogers.
Come on up.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I don't think you're first. I think you're third, but I think she's next.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales and commissioners. Thank you for staying so late for this testimony and for all the work that you're doing. I'm Kate Titus, and I'm here representing Common Cause. I'm the executive director of the Common Cause Oregon chapter. And I've submitted written testimony, which you'll get copies of, basically expressing our support for the measures. Rather than go over that right now, I want to comment on what's being said, because I think that's more relevant, hearing the comments on the floor. And one thing I'd like to say is just listening to lobbyists like myself or people in a public service elected official role like yourselves.
I'm sorry, did you need to disclose?
That's not the reason for my comment, though. But listening to any of us in these roles speak about ethics rules is a little bit like listening to white people talk about racism. And not to make anyone feel uncomfortable, I'll just speak to my own experience. You know, I am white, and I think of myself as a good person, and I don't intend racism. And it's also, since I am not the brunt of most racism, it's easy for me not to see it and believe it doesn't exist. So when I talk about racism, it's very easy for me to write it off. And I think we have to be careful that all of us in the role of lobbyists and public officials recognize that our scope of understanding the ethics issue is somewhat limited, and not to assume that our own individual experience with it and opinion is really representative of what the broader public that we are accountable to sees and experiences. I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of ethics rules that's come up in the conversation. This is not primarily about us setting rules to deal with the bad guys. It does that, prevents corruption of bad guys, but first and foremost, we're actually talking about setting clear guidance for the many good guys, like hopefully all of ourselves, who go into public service wanting to be accountable to the public. I think the nature of this is that we're not talking about just preventing our own self-interest and going astray. The reality is we are all facing many conflicted interests daily, and it's other people's interests of us. We may all have the very best intentions, but the reality is we have to navigate multiple interests all the time in the roles that we're playing. And so there needs to be clear guidance of how to navigate those roles to ensure the public trust, uphold the public trust, and many people have raised that up, that it's as much the appearance as anything, but also to ensure that our own actions are putting the public interest first. And I know we all like to think that that's what we're doing at every moment, because that's what we're intending to do. But if you talk for 5 minutes with any social psychologist, you know that there is a level at which we're all influenced by various incentives unintentionally and below our even conscious awareness. So we don't even understand often the ways that we are being influenced. That's the purpose of ethics rules primarily. So it's not impugning anyone, and I don't think anybody needs to be defensive, but we need to have clear guidelines, and I think it's really great that the auditor's office has taken the initiative to update and continue to keep our ethics rules strong. The one last point I'll just highlight, and this is in my written testimony, but best practice around that cooling off period or revolving doors is when there's any substantial personal involvement in an issue, actually you never again, you've given up your right to then lobby on the private side and the public side of that interest. 2 years for other things, and most officials, is considered standard good practice. You will see 1 year many times, but it's often considered a little too superficial and cosmetic. So what the auditor is proposing is in line with best practice around the country in terms of two years. And I know that there is a tension. It can drive away good talent and make it difficult. I appreciate the challenge that all of us face in sometimes having to limit ourselves or our staffs staffs from taking other roles. But the reality is, it's not about any of us individually, Ron Paul, yourself, myself. We have no entitlement to professional advances. If we choose to go in and represent the public, then what becomes uppermost is we set up systems that ensure that the public accountability to the public interest is always first. That's our intention, of course, going into it, but we have to make sure that there are guidelines for navigating those many inevitable conflicts of interest. So those are my comments.
Thank you.
Craig Rogers, Portland Citizen. I support this proposal, and the reason why I'm speaking was because I did hear the remark of alluding to perhaps things were squeaky clean in this city and in this state. Nonetheless, a year ago, our Governor Kate Brown emphasized transparent and accountable. I believe that that was in part in reaction to who she was replacing, because the Kitzhaber administration, the last administration, was not necessarily transparent and accountable. And a local example is with the parking meters, and I believe the FBI was involved with that. That's probably something that whoever was involved with that didn't really want it out there. And an example that I was involved with was the basis numbers during the street fee that actually some of my colleagues had to go to court to get that basis number. And I believe that when they got that number, it was wrong, and it showed that actually the biggest employer in the city of Portland was Colonics Clinic with 32,000 employees. So I think that transparent and accountable is important, and I really support the intentions of this. Myself, I've been in leadership roles with Coca-Cola and the Teamsters Union, and there were certain guidelines that I had to abide by, and not only did I represent the members and employees better, but they made me a better person.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Watchdog PDX. One of the concerns I heard is that from the elected officials and the directors, I myself, in my opinion, think the staff also needs to have the two-year and or more limit placed on them. And the reason why I say that is that what I don't want to see is that if you have an aggressive lobbyist company and they understand the importance of having that inside information if they can possibly get that advantage. And what I don't want to see is the company making offers to potential staff that are currently working for the city with the statement of, we can hire you maybe in 1 to 2 years when you're done working here. And also, in a way, making that staff individual feel like, well, maybe I can show them why you might want to hire me. So I want to have a cutoff point made very clear that when you're a public servant, don't expect to go work for that, become a lobbyist immediately. It's not going to happen. Don't expect offers to be made prior to you leaving City Hall. And it's the same thing I have a problem here, too, is that let's talk a city attorney that's worked for the city for many years. Where do they fit into this equation if they leave and go to and become a lobbyist? I mean, of all the people that I would have the most concern of any information on city business would be through the attorneys, because they know what's going on at this city. They understand the details of it. They understand certain problems. They are the ones that I would be watching very close to possibly ever becoming a lobbyist based upon their knowledge of what goes on at this city. So I have a lot of mixed feelings on this. And I heard the mayor, if I was correct, say that I don't ever want to be a lobbyist when I leave here.
You heard that correctly.
So, but when you do make that statement, then what would be the concern about having a two-year cooling-off period for everybody at the city? Because you don't want to be a lobbyist, but there is a concern for the public to look at this and say, they have a lot of information. I don't necessarily want them to just go to become a lobbyist and begin to influence policy. I want to have the same advantage. I want to have the public from the special interest to the general interest. And this lobbyist issue is a big concern to me.
Right, because the difference, Lighting, under our code is that you become a lobbyist not when you go buy an expensive suit and show up on the 15th floor of an office building down the street with gold letter on the front.
Right.
You become a lobbyist if you become the head of a local nonprofit that works with the Parks Bureau or with any other city bureau on providing public services. You are a lobbyist under our code if you do a lot of things,
yes,
not just work as a paid lobbyist for clients.
And at that point, what I'm saying is that the lobbyists currently out there that have the true knowledge of what they're trying to do and how they're trying to get certain things done are the ones that are going to focus on the most knowledgeable people at the city to try to have them work alongside them or special interest groups that they want to ensure that they can have maybe possibly some influence. And that's a big concern to me on not having something set into place. And in my opinion, Mayor, I'll say this, is you made a statement, I don't ever want to be a lobbyist when I leave City Hall. In my opinion, any elected official and the mayor should never become a lobbyist. Under the definition of lobbyist, which I do agree there's a lot more interpretation on that and understanding on what that truly means by this ordinance.
Yeah, the trouble is we use that word, which applies to professionals.
Right.
So Maggie Talmadge, who works for the Coalition of Communities of Color, also serves on our Planning and Sustainability Commission. Is she a lobbyist when she shows up on behalf of the Coalition of Communities of Color? She's paid. She's on their staff. She's meeting with city officials on subjects of equity. I think she qualifies as a lobbyist.
And that's my point. I think there needs to be a lot more interpretation on that term and a clear understanding. And I'd like to have the city attorneys also get involved in on this because they, I think, have a more clear understanding on how what that term really means. And my position is that I don't want to see certain information leaving City Hall in a reasonable manner and utilized in people's position that I think there needs to be a cooling off period. I really do, especially on staff because, in my opinion, staff is just as important as these elected officials and the mayor up here. And I would fairly say this, is that a lot of that staff has just as much knowledge, if not more knowledge, than some of you sitting up here. So that's my concern. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Others on this item? Yeah, I'm going to recommend that we ask the auditor to form some kind of a work group with some more representation from our offices. I'm not going to be here next week, so I don't think this could come back to the council that quickly. So I'd like to maybe set this over for 30 days and give you the chance to form a work group and work on some of the issues that have been raised today.
I would be happy to follow up on some of the issues that were raised and to talk more with you all about those issues.
Great. Good. Thank you. Okay.
Can I just respond to something? Commissioner Saltzman, I just have to come to the defense of Deborah Scroggin. This is not, we came here today because this code exists already, and we have had some activity in the last year where we got to investigate cases and to try out those enforcement mechanisms, and we found that there were some gaps there and some problems. And so we came here today in good faith to try to strengthen the code that exists. I said at the outset that we were not trying to wildly expand things, and that we were trying to keep it within the resources that we already devote to this program. And Deborah did not go off to a conference and come up with some wild hair idea to come back here. And I just am very disappointed that you characterized why we are here that way, and that is an unfair representation of Deborah's role.
I guess I differ with you because when I met with you on this rule, I expressed to you from the outset my concern about extending this two-year no contact period, whatever you want to call it. And I asked, cooling off here, I asked where she got this idea, And she said, at a conference, it was a best practice listed. So you were there. You were in that
right.
meeting.
Right, and it is a best practice. And I think
but
we've
it
had
was at a conference. She says you learned it at a conference.
I don't believe that's what I said.
No, she said.
But I don't believe that's true. I don't think she learned it at a conference.
Well, we'll settle that later. Yeah. So let me suggest it.
I won't test for my memory 100%, but that's pretty. I'm pretty clear on that. I would not have gone out of a limb like that if I didn't believe that to be the case.
Well, I think if you disagree with provisions or and you did express that you know there's ways that you can do that, but I just wanted to call you on the fact that that was, I think, very unfair to Deborah.
Really noted. All right, so I'm going to continue this to May 11th.
Actually, Mayor, I just wanted, speaking solely for myself, I just wanted to make one comment, which is that I think that there's pieces of this proposal which strike me as no-brainers that I would think that we could implement pretty quickly and I would hope people agree with. I thought that the changing from 8 hours to 8 hours or $1,000 sounds perfectly reasonable, and raising the penalty threshold from 500 to 3,000 for multiple violations, that strikes me as eminently reasonable too. So it may be that we can split apart the less controversial and more controversial pieces of this proposal and enact some like those very quickly with no work grouping.
Okay, that's a good idea. Maybe we can try to do that as well. Okay, so I'll continue this to May 11th, give that process a chance to work. Thank you very much. Okay, what's